Brian Had a Dream. 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000. This is Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome once again to the quest for 10,000. We're so happy that you have joined us on this next step of Brian's journey to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. Once again, we are joined by our friend Andy.
Hi.
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 Thanks for having me.
Very cordial.
We're very glad to have you and have all you listeners. Please do take some time. If you enjoy this podcast, let us know on Twitter at 10kmovies or visit Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com, and join in the conversation about all things that are theatrical and are worth watching on film. Today, our topic of discussion is going to be independent films. This is a subject where Andy might have some additional perspective, being that he lives in New York City, and I just kind of think there are so many indie films that seem to be set in urban areas like New York.
Yeah,
so, Andy, your perspective as a resident of New York, I think, could be really helpful. We'll also look at Brian's top five films that are set in New York City, as well as do our usual reviews. But before all that, we are just going to jump in. And this was a topic that I started thinking of a lot initially, more so than Brian. And the reason I was thinking about it is that, to me, independent movie as a genre is not something that seems to be quite as widespread in other entertainment genres, or quite as well accepted as part of the sort of a mainstream sort of thing as is in other entertainment genres.
Well,
now that's not to say that there. I know there's things
sure.
like independent music.
Sure.
I know
but independent music
independent
is very regionalized. Like if you're on an independent label, probably that label has a reach of a certain area and doesn't really go beyond that. If you want to get beyond that, you're going to have to sign with one of the bigger labels somewhere. So there's nothing like that in film where you have a small, you know, like this is the distributor for New York or this is the distributor for the Southeast. That
right.
doesn't happen.
So maybe the first question is just to say, kind of for everybody, what is it that makes a film an independent film?
Well, you know, it meant a lot more even 10, 15 years ago when it was something done outside of the studio system where there was no studio money kind of backing it. And now that's still relatively true, but now you have even major studios have entire divisions of their studio that is devoted to just making smaller independent films.
Mm-hmm.
So how independent is that?
Now that's a good question too. Has independent sort of become kind of a buzzword for just a different
something
type of studio
film. It becomes
film.
A marketing tool or whatever.
Right. And I'll also be interested just in hear what insight you might have, Brian, you too, Andy, about what is it about movies that lends itself maybe well to an independent sort of frame of mind. I have my own thoughts, but would like to hear what y'all have to say,
well,
too.
Well, as far as, you know, what started it, this recent trend or whatever, I know there was some in the late 80s, but it was still sort of not, it was present and it was vibrant, but it wasn't necessarily a nationwide kind of thing. I think a turning point for a lot of us was in the early 90s when Clerks came out, and not just the movie itself, which was obviously a kind of a phenomenon under a certain segment of the population, but the way Kevin Smith would talk about how he made this movie. You know, he just said, I mean, he would in interviews say, you get some credit cards, you max them out, and then you make it. And, I mean, I know for 16, 17-year-old kids to hear that, you think, I can do that, you know? So it whether it did any good or whether it wound up with a lot of people in a lot of bad debt, I don't know. But it made it seem like, wait a minute, that's something I can do too. And so that kind of broke down
right.
some barriers, I think.
Yeah, and it strikes me that maybe also as we move to a more technologically savvy culture, as we
mm-hmm.
continue to do that, and that sort of cliche of, you know, even our 3-year-olds know more about operating an iPad than we do. It, again, created more accessibility. That's a word we've used a lot on this podcast. But there's people who can kind of pick up a little bit like we're doing right now, like podcasting. We need a microphone and a computer, and we can podcast. To make a movie, I think for some folks there's a sense of, well, we need to know someone a little bit who kind of knows sound and someone who can work a video, and we can kind of act out an improv
and
do that.
And that's
kind of
one thing that, and I know there are a lot of people in Hollywood. It feels like every year you read an article about how somebody's mad because they no longer make movies in film. You know, like Tarantino made The Hateful Eight in film in 70mm, and they were like, oh, you know, how great he's doing this, because other people are, you know, you have people like him and Scorsese and even Spielberg, or people who complain about the dying of film because Kodak no longer makes film stock and all this kind of stuff. And my answer to them is, so, like, it does, I mean, and I think that's how most people feel, because I think what that does, whether it's artistically better or not, it created a barrier that prevented certain people from getting through, because film stock is very expensive and cameras are very expensive. And so if you don't have the money, you can't play the game.
Right.
But now when these other materials come along, you know, it levels the playing field in a way where I may not have $20,000, but I can buy an $800 phone. You know, and so it makes it accessible. And so I think some of that is, some of it is an artistic choice and lamenting that, but some of it is, I think, the fear that they no longer have control.
Right.
And they can't choose who can and can't make the movies they want and don't want.
Right. Now, Andy, you've got experience, you know, dabbling here and there with audio production, recording, you know, some video, that kind of stuff. Would you agree with that the technology has developed to an extent where with just a little bit of training, someone can just kind of pick some stuff off the street and could kind of go try to make a movie or make something? I mean, what's your take on that side of it?
Well, it seems like it. I mean, you look at, for example, Apple does commercials for each new version of the iPhone using the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And only the iPhone for the recording, the editing, all the pieces. So there's a bit of a leveling of the playing field that I think has gone into this. I also think there's the independent genre has a focus on the individual, on the unknown individual.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, yeah, you have these big names, the Scorseses, the Spielbergs. You know, you've got those big names, but you don't have. But then. And it's their vision, but this gives the average Joe, somebody who doesn't have the experience, the long story, the big history, with the chance to cast their own vision and sketch out their own path.
That's interesting, because I think, too, one of the criticisms I've heard a lot, you know, now of Hollywood, is that most of what you see are these big budget productions, sequels, and there's not a whole lot of originality and thought.
There's not.
And it seems like the independent genre, whether or not it truly is this, there does seem to be this aura with it of this sort of romantic kind of thing and this place where originality can still exist and do that. One of the places where I've noticed more quote-unquote independent fare, particularly, is on Netflix.
My
queue
seems really
to be
opening
full.
It up.
My recommendations seem to be full
it opens
of
it
movies
up.
That, like, that's actors I've seen, directors I've heard of, but these just little quirky kind of, and it's sort of these low budget things that,
well, Netflix,
that's surprising in some ways that they still get made.
Netflix has been a godsend to people like this, because it gives them an opportunity to get their product out in front of people that would never have even heard of it without this opportunity. And it's this is why studios are scared of what Netflix is doing. They're also scared that it's going to ruin the theatrical distribution model, which, okay, I mean, adapt. But, you know, you say lack of originality. It kind of irks me, because I kind of think nobody complains about the lack of originality in theater productions. I mean, nobody complains that there's a whole award, the whole Tony Award, just given to the best revival of a play that has happened before. Like, they have a whole set that nobody gives, like, a best sequel Oscar. That doesn't happen. But you, or best remake Oscar. But you have a whole thing that says you brought up something and you're bringing it back, and that's great and that's creative and important. But we complain when people do it with the movies. I don't understand why that's not. I mean, there's a long tradition of, like, you think of how many performances all of Shakespeare's plays have had, and nobody says that's more, you know, morally bankrupt or wrong of you to be doing, oh, another King Lear. Oh, we've seen that before. I mean, I don't understand why that's so horrible a thing. You can still be creative and original and vibrant and fresh with old material.
And that ties in, for me, the concept, too, of the tone that a lot of those movies try to strike. And the atmosphere they try to strike. For some reason, I really always, when I think independent movie, truly the first thing I think of is New York City. Just think of New York City. And maybe that's because there's something about even the notion of New York, particularly for people who don't live there. There's something about this notion of New York that also is at times kind of romantic and original and independent and sort of resistant in some ways to, in certain parts, the glitz and glamour. Although at the same time, it's part of a larger sphere.
I don't know that New York, but I do always think of some sort of urban environment.
Yeah.
I don't think of independent movies that are about farm life in Iowa. Like, you know, I just don't, that's not, I mean, I'm sure there are some, and I think, you know, Gus Van Sant did My Private Idaho or whatever, which is smaller, but that's not what I think of. You know, I think of something in a city and in, like, really a grittier version of Friends is what I think of when I think of independent, you know, it's almost,
what's set in New York City?
It's almost what I, right. Yeah, almost that, that's the quintessential, like, I think the image of what an independent film is.
And this is something Andy and I were talking about, because... Two, it seems that in New York City, there's a reputation of a lot of same thing, lots of things being accessible at once. Like over here, you have movies being filmed and going on in New York, whether it's big budget or maybe some just person with a video camera is going to post something on YouTube. Over here, you have Broadway and stuff, and over here you have TV. And Andy, what do you think happens when all those kind of worlds cross over and collide, and what effect does it have? Does that make things just way more accessible? Does it play into that again, or does it make things harder, do you think, for different entertainment sort of genres to take hold and do stuff?
I think it definitely expands your pool of quality talent, because you've got people who are willing and able to act in three different genres, film, television, and they might bring even musical talent to it as well. So that changes it. Another thing that I think we miss about thinking about New York, and I didn't even mention this earlier, there's tons of students in New York. There are film schools everywhere. NYU is generally regarded as having the best film program in the country, especially for people who want to be independent filmmakers.
Yeah.
So they go to New York and they do, and they learn that, and you go around and like half of the film shoots you might see are actually students just going through the subway and shooting a scene just with regular people there.
Yeah.
Versus a closed set model, which is what you, locations on a closed set and that sort of thing, which you do see for a lot of other stuff. But there's something about the energy that comes from students and young people along the way that I think makes New York a unique place for independent filmmaking, even though it's like the center of the corporate world for so many of these corporations.
And although, too, it's interesting you say that, because something you had said before, too, is that your opinion, there's probably more television production that occurs
in New York City
than not. And that, for the most part, if something's set in New York, most New Yorkers can tell you how that's not actually New York.
Right. Yeah, you look at, for example, How I Met Your Mother, which is one of the great theoretical New York sitcoms of, but it's really more urban than anything, and if a New Yorker looks at it, you're going, that's a soundstage. The subway entrances are just wrong.
And Seinfeld was on the soundstage in Los Angeles after like season 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, other than the exterior shots and things they kept using.
I walk past the restaurant sign 2 or 3 times a week, actually.
Again, it's sort of fascinating that there's something about just movies in general that that anyone can sort of feel like they could go and make one, they could go and do it. And
well, some of that is because it's a still a relatively young art form. You know, I mean, motion picture cameras are only roughly about 120 years old. So, you know, compare that to any other art form, and the giants of the form have not really been established yet, or they're still sort of malleable, you know, and that makes it more accessible.
You could say the same thing about television.
Television is a subgenre of movie.
Okay, say more about that.
Well, I mean, motion pictures came first. Television was an extension of that. In some ways, it's overtaken it, I think.
And they become distinct in a lot of ways, too.
But they're not. They've become collapsed in a lot of ways, too. I mean, in 20 years ago, if you were a movie star, you did not go on television. And now, that's no longer the case, because television is in some ways as prestigious as being in a movie is, depending on the movie. But and I think part of that is because I think we have only recently begun to understand the storytelling capabilities of long-form television.
Well, and maybe part of that, too, is that we've only begun to now to see a little glimpses and glimmers of independent TV.
Well, I prefer to think of, like, television right now to be, like, novels before, and then you had War and Peace, this long novel. You can do War and Peace on a television. You cannot do War and Peace in a theater and expect people to sit through it.
Yeah. Right.
That can't happen.
Right.
Because they just don't have that kind of, they don't have that kind of time or endurance or whatever it is. But if you parcel it out, they may be able to watch the whole thing in a different format. You know, so it just opens you up to these much longer, more in-depth stories.
Last thing I want to bring up on this topic. In our Groundhog Day episode, you talked about the movie that Bill Murray did after Ghostbusters.
Okay, yeah, The Razor's Edge.
The Razor's Edge. A movie he did was kind of an independent, small movie that he did because he did the big budget movie.
And
Joss Whedon, after he did Avengers,
mm-hmm.
he did Much Ado About Nothing, which was basically him inviting all of his friends to his house and filming in black and white this Shakespearean adaptation.
Yeah.
Just with modern dress and one house rather than...
And did it like over 2 weeks.
And Whedon, in an interview or something about this, you know, said, you know, yeah, you do one for them, you do one for you. And so again, there's something about that independent genre that I think will continue to pull filmmakers and directors, even if it's just sort of a subsidiary and extension of the studio, because there is something about the creative control, doing something of value,
getting people together to
execute a vision where you don't have a whole lot of notes coming from the corporate.
Well, anybody that, especially people that talk about it as being an art, those people, they may want to direct a Superman movie or whatever, but that's not, they want to be an artist. And you know, there may be potential in that, but there's more potential to really plumb some sort of, like, you know, depths outside of these things, because these things become money making machines. I mean, like, you know, you've got to consider, you know, even in a Marvel movie, you can't make your story decisions are based on what's going to happen in three movies later. Like, if you can't decide this character needs to die here, wait, we have plans for you're constantly being battled and constrained and being told, no, that story has to be subservient to this bigger story, which in some ways it's starting to become a point where the real auteur is the Kevin Feige or whatever his name is. He's the guy who's created all of this, you know, this
studio head.
Yeah, he's the guy that's responsible for this.
In some sense, the corporate.
Yeah. But you know, your storytelling or whatever you want to do is severely restrained when you are, you're worried about how much money you're going to make, and not just how much money, how much over $500 million you're going to make.
Well, you know what? That's not a worry for this podcast.
No.
I will tell you that this is really kind of the first part of a discussion on independent filmmaking, because in our next episode, we're going to talk about Brian's own experience as an independent filmmaker with him and some of his other friends. So stay tuned that episode. Brian just did air quotes. You can't see that in the podcast.
You can hear it in my voice, however.
You can't hear it in the voice. Well, what we want to hear from you now, though, Brian, is a couple of reviews. Again, movies that you've seen lately. Where are you in the number of films you've watched on the way to 10,000?
Right now, it's at 64.18.
Okay, and are you continuing to average about how many movies per day?
Well, it depends. You know, someday depends on how many short films I get in, but, you know, 3 to 4 is a good average.
And so for a week, you're at, like, 20?
That's a good, some weeks more, some weeks, it depends. I mean, some weeks I try to push it and try to get...
But average it maybe around 20.
That's probably okay. That's probably
well, average. Tell us two of the 20 that you've watched most recently.
Well, just recently, saw a movie that has really gotten a lot of good press and a lot of good reviews, and it's out in theaters now, Deadpool, which is a different kind of movie for Marvel. We talked about them worrying about their bottom line. Or this feels more like an independent. I mean, it's not, but it feels more like an independent because it's really pushing boundaries and saying, you know, we're not going to be kid friendly. They don't mind going breaking the fourth wall. They don't mind being as meta as they want to be. I'm curious to see. Cause my understanding is that this is going to be worked into the X-Men franchise. Okay, mm-hmm. At one point, Colossus is in the movie. And at one point, he's talking to Colossus, and he says something about Professor X. And he goes, is this Patrick Stewart, or is this the other guy? Because I get my timelines confused. So, I mean, you know, just it's just funny that I'm wondering if in subsequent movies, if this character, he will be kind of, like, aware and making jokes, but all the other characters will have to play it as if they don't. Like, he talks a good bit about his crush on Wolverine. He talks about that all the time. Like, he just talks about how he has a man crush on a guy, and he goes, I won't tell you his name, but it rhymes with Wolverine.
I mean, what about, is it mainly an origin story?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It starts off when he's going out, and then it works backwards and does flashbacks, and yeah, it's an origin story.
So it's that typical Marvel.
Yeah, it's typical, like, structure. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But,
okay, what's something else, real brief,
let me see
that here. You've seen?
Yeah, I can give you
some. You mentioned a short film. What's a short film you've seen?
Oh, well, I've been watching some Tex Avery cartoons, some old Warner Brothers cartoons. I tell you, this movie on this website called Mubi. I guess it's called Mubi. It's MUBI. I don't know what it really stands for. That I subscribed to had a documentary about Dennis Hopper. And it was filmed while he was trying to do some other movie. And
I thought you were going to say while he was doing cocaine. But.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was crazy. This was after Easy Rider, and he was trying to do a follow-up film. And this documentary apparently has not been really seen in large circles, but they have it, and they're showing it now. But he was a crazy dude. He really was. He really thought he was much more powerful than he was.
Right.
You know, I think he overestimated his own strengths, but he may have had a bit of a god complex.
Right.
I mean, I like Dennis Hopper, but...
So Deadpool, thumbs up for sure.
Well, this is called The American Dreamer, and I'm going to say thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Don't
okay.
watch it. All Don't right. watch it.
Well, from movies that you should and shouldn't watch to... Now, movies that Brian really probably couldn't recommend enough. Top 5 movies. And in honor of Andy being from New York, currently residing in New York, what, Brian, are your top 5 movies that are based in New York City?
Well, going through this list, it's hard to, you know, weed out. There's so many movies. So I'm going to say this is my top 5, but I'm also going to say it's more like just a 5 really good.
Okay.
I don't want to label it as because I know I may.
You know you're forgetting something.
I know I'm forgetting like 2 or 3 because I know you mentioned one that I'm trying to work in where it's going to be because it should be on the list because you know it's quintessential. And some of these are not necessarily they're set in New York, but outside of the fact that they tell you they're set in New York, there's no reason for you to associate New York with the movie.
So you try to kind of pick movies where New York's a character.
I'm trying to. Some of them I succeeded, some of them I didn't, okay. But I'm trying to get movies that are like, it couldn't have been set in Ohio or in Boston or in Chicago.
Yeah.
It had to be in New York.
Okay.
And so that's a little bit different. Coming in at number 5, It's a movie from the, I think it's from 45. It's called Scarlet Street. It's a film noir movie with Edward G. Robinson. He plays a guy who's been in a company man, retiring. He wants to be a painter, and then he gets mixed up with this con artist couple and this woman that convinces him he loves her, and then they're going to sell his paintings, and he winds up killing. It's really good. I think it's by Fritz Lang. I think it's old. Number four, a movie I've talked a little bit before, A Thousand Clowns. This is from the mid '60s. Has Martin Balsam in it, the guy who was the inspector in Psycho. He's the guy who fell down the stairs in a Psycho. That's what I think that's what most people would know him as. It's got Jason Robards in it, and it's about this unconventional guy who works for he wants to be something more than that. But he works for a children's programming in New York City. But he's kind of an iconoclast in his actual life. He doesn't really care. He says what he thinks, and he does this kind of stuff. But he's forced to try to raise his nephew. And there's this struggle about how you can't necessarily always live your life the way you want to when other people depend on you. You know, you kind of have to make some sort of sacrifices.
Number three,
The Avengers.
Okay.
Obviously,
I was hoping that would show up on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
we already mentioned
New York.
Joss Whedon.
Well, I mean, and I'm gonna go ahead and lump in with the Avengers all of those superhero movies, like Spider-Man. You know, I'm gonna lump it in together.
It's kind of assumed all the.
Yeah, because Spider-Man. I mean, I know when Spider-Man 1 or 2, but I think it was 1. They had to go back in and digitally remove the Twin Towers from scenes because it was so painful
for
people to watch.
Film right before, or at least right after.
Yeah. So I'm going to, you know, but all of those superhero movies that are set in New York and how...
And New York's very much a prominent, just on the level of New York's under peril. So it's sort of the damsel in distress.
Well, and I'm even going to say, even the Batman movies that are set in Gotham, they're in New York. let's be fair.
That's true.
Whatever, you can say what you want to. That's New York City.
Number two.
Number two, I am going to say a recent movie that I've talked about, you know I like it a lot, Birdman. It's set in New York's theatrical sort of scene. There's not a lot of, you know, when you think about it now, I don't know of a lot of movies that are set on Broadway or have Broadway as being a big part of what they're doing. But, I mean, this one, he's walking the streets of Broadway. It's clearly in that area. And, you know, that's fascinating to me. It's fascinating to me that him to be a character who's much like Michael Keaton himself, who's trying to get... You know, late in his career, trying to get some sort of critical respect, and thinks that it has to come through Broadway. You know, it has to come through. If you can't get the respect of the New York critics, then you're not good. You know, and I think that's true. I think you see a lot of people that want to trot out and go out on Broadway for whatever reason.
Right, number one.
And number one, this is one that you brought to my attention. It wasn't originally going to be on my list because I had overlooked it and forgotten it. But I'm going to say Ghostbusters is quintessentially New York.
Yes.
It's quintessential.
Yes. Okay. What makes it quintessential?
Well, I mean, Ghostbusters 2, the Statue of Liberty comes to life. I mean, that in itself makes it kind of. But you know, they're on the Empire State Building is where they go at the top of when Zool and the Gatekeeper and all this kind of stuff. They're at the New York Public Library at one point. I mean, they're clearly in and around clearing ghosts out of New York. So
I can't argue with that one. But I don't live in New York. Andy, real quick, what do you think of Brian's list? Good. What's he missing? Anything?
I mean, you could say that it's missing Woody Allen.
Yeah, and I have a Woody Allen in here, but I didn't mention him because you know,
it's
I guess
cliche.
Manhattan is kind of has New York as a character, but the rest of his movies could take place anywhere.
Right.
And they're not in New York; they just are in New York.
But you know what, listeners? If you think Woody Allen should have been in
I love Woody Allen.
Five,
he is in my heart.
Any of his movies should have been in his top five. Let us know on Twitter at 10kmovies on 10kmovies.com. Join the discussion as we continue to journey with Brian to watch those 10,000 movies before he turns 40. Until then, hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11.